Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the history of a disease, the disease in question being sickle cell anemia, but also looking at the ways in which illness and race and politics can all come together to influence one another. And our guest for the program is Keith Whaler. He is professor of social medicine and history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and has authored a book which is titled Dying in the City of the Blues, which looks at the issue of sickle cell anemia and very specifically at the city of Memphis, which was the location for some of the first sickle cell clinics in this country. As we talk with our guest, you should certainly feel free to be a part of the conversation. Questions are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we can keep moving along and accommodate as many different callers as possible. Anyone's welcome, though, into the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And at any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. The book, by the way, if you're interested in reading it, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Professor Whaler, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to your readers.
And I hope, am I pronouncing your name correctly, by the way?
It is Whaler. That's right.
All right, good. I try. As someone who's gone through life having my name mispronounced a lot, I try my best to get other people's names correct.
Well, I've heard lots of mispronunciations, so you've done admirably.
This is, as I said, it's in part a history of sickle cell disease and how it is that people have, that is in the medical field and the scientific field, have thought about it over time. But it's not, in a sense, it's not a conventional medical history. I think you were trying to do something a little bit different as you charted the arc of how it is that we have thought about this disease in this country. And indeed, it has been an arc, I think, from the initial point where it was first recognized to exist to the point where a great deal of attention was given to it and services were provided, healthcare services were provided to African Americans. And then there was a down part of the arc to the point where it seems that today it's hardly discussed at all. And the way that we think about it has changed a great deal.
Yes, I think that conventionally, when one thinks of the history of medicine or the history of health or the history of disease, one thinks of a story about clinical symptoms, patients, and one thinks of maybe the transformation of the scientific understanding of the disease. And as you suggest, I've tried to do something very much different, which is to look at how the history of this particular disorder, its early invisibility, the fact that it was not recognized as a discrete disease and certainly not recognized as prevalent as it actually is, and why that early invisibility existed. How, and then I've turned to the question of how it is that a disease that is obscure can become both significant in clinics, significant in society, and take on the sort of political significance that it does in the late 60s, early 70s. I trace that story in America, but I also end up focusing my narrative on the specific transformation in Memphis and the Mid-South. And as you suggest, when you think about a disease that way, you know, what you're trying to do is to use the disease almost as a window on broader issues involving science, race relations, medicine, politics, and society. You mentioned earlier that, you know, in subsequent discussion, you'll be looking at the West Nile virus and what it tells us, not just about the biology of the disease itself, but about society. And that's very much the same sort of motivation behind the kind of work that I've done. Just to be specific, that one cannot understand the increasing significance of sickle cell disease as a scientific or as a social and political issue in the 1960s without understanding how it was characterized as a disease of pain and suffering among African Americans that had long gone ignored. You can see how it easily fit in with the broader motifs in civil rights and in sort of consciousness raising of the 1960s. And it's that story, as well as the story of science and medicine and people's experience with the disorder, that I try to capture in this book.
Yeah. Just before talking a little bit maybe specifically about Memphis, mm-hmm. for those people who are not familiar, who are not really sure what sickle cell disease is, we will not try to overwhelm them with medical detail, but perhaps I should ask you just to talk a little bit about sickle cell disease and what it is.
Sure. Well, sickle cell disease is a disorder that's characterized by recurrent painful episodes, frequent infections, joint pains, commonly infections, early death from infants, and its causes are linked to a missubstitution of an amino acid on the hemoglobin, to be technical, on the hemoglobin molecule within the red blood cells, which causes those cells to take on a sickled shape. So that whereas normal red blood cells are oval or round in shape, these sickled cells tend to cause obstructions. They tend to cause physiological damage. They're partly responsible for the pain that patients experience. And they result in, as I said, frequent infections and early death, high rates of infant mortality. This has changed over the course of the century. But that's the basics of the disease. As in the by around 1950s, it became clear that also this was a hereditary disease, and by that it's meant that parents with something called sickle cell trait who carry one allele or one gene for the disease, who are not themselves sick, they are people who simply, as I say, carry one allele. If they were to marry someone else who carries that allele, and they have children with that other person, the children have a 25% chance of inheriting one of those alleles from both of the parents, in which case the children develop sickle cell disease. So it's depending on how you think about it, you can think about it as a disease that's painful. You can think about it as a disease that is characterized by early infant death. You can think about it as a chronic disease as we've developed more medications to help alleviate some of the symptoms. You can think about it as a molecular disease that has its origins in this peculiar missubstitution of amino acid in the hemoglobin. Or you can think about it as a hereditary disease. And in many ways, all of those are kind of scientifically correct ways of thinking about it. What I try to do is look at the development of that understanding, but also to put it into a social context.
Mm-hmm. The disease was officially recognized in 1910, I believe, by a physician in Chicago.
That's right.
Who took a blood sample from a young medical student who was from West Indies and looked at it, and he saw these sickle-shaped blood cells, and that's where the name comes from. So at this point, it was quote-unquote discovered, although, of course, people had experienced it and its symptoms had been experiencing them for some time. But before we actually had a name for it and the medical community said, yes, this is a disease, this is what we know about it, to what were the symptoms that people experienced, which you have talked about, attributed?
That's a terrific question. And in fact, as you're alluding to, that as a historian, you know, we're kind of like detectives. We're trying to figure out what experiences people actually had. We know this disease was around before it was recognized by James Herrick in Chicago in 1910 and written about in American medical journals. So the challenge is often to kind of figure out, well, if medical science doesn't recognize this disorder, and certainly people are having it, what would they have been having? And that involves a certain amount of sort of creative medical historical interpretation. From what I could determine, it was, since most of the children with sickle cell disease would have died early, it would have been attributed to what you might just call unexplained infant mortality. And since in the early 20th century, the heavy burden of children's infectious disease was still quite extensive. Pneumonia, tuberculosis, and other sorts of infectious diseases. Most of these deaths would have simply been attributed to some other disorder because, in fact, the children would not have died of sickle cell disease per se. They would have died of the infections that they're particularly vulnerable to, not in much the same way that people with AIDS die because they have a crippled immune system, which makes them obviously more susceptible to things like tuberculosis, Kaposi sarcoma, etc. So the story of sickle cell disease in the early 20th century is very much the story of trying to use one's historical judgment to figure out where these cases would have ended up, because they certainly, even in the wake of James Herrick's discovery, they wouldn't have been described as a discrete pathology. They would have blurred into the background of these broader problems in society.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Keith Whalo. He is a professor of social medicine and history at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and is the author of this book that we mentioned that is a history of sickle cell anemia, the subtitle Sickle Cell Anemia and the Politics of Race and Health. And it does indeed look at how these things, illness, politics, race, all do come together and affect one another. And you can certainly see that in the various ways in which we have thought about this disease in America, going back to 1910 when it was officially identified and then coming to the present time. His book is titled Dying in the City of the Blues. It's published by University of North Carolina Press. And questions, welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Let's now come back to the question of why it is that you chose to focus on Memphis in this particular book.
Well, there are a couple of answers to that. One is that, you know, scholars often stumble across the topics. I began teaching here at UNC, at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1993, and I was finishing my first book, which focused on blood and ideas about blood and blood disease, and there was one chapter of it that focused on sickle cell disease. And I became aware through my early research of a particular pathologist, a scientist named Lemuel Diggs, whose career started in the 1920s in Memphis, and he appeared to be incredibly productive, focusing almost exclusively on sickle cell disease through much of his career. And so when I first got to Chapel Hill, I decided to look for any papers he might have left behind. He was born in 1900, and when I called the archivist said, well, you know, Dr. Diggs still comes in from time to time. And I was, of course, stunned. This is 1993. He must have been 93. He was 93 years old. Mm-hmm. And she also said that he was quite lucid and fascinating to talk to, and I called him up and actually visited with him a few times. And he showed me in these scrapbooks that he had actually followed this disease, not simply as a scientist, as a clinician, as a physician, but also in its social significance. And it's through these scrapbooks that he'd kept of black newspapers, local newspapers, writings, any writings on sickle cell disease he could find. It's really through that those conversations with him that I came to see that this the story of how this disease became significant in Memphis, for instance, really tells you a great deal about changing attitudes towards race and race relations. And long before it became a national issue with sickle cell legislation in 1972, it was important, you might say, as a civic issue in places like Memphis, where giving money to Diggs's clinic, supporting the goal of alleviating pain and suffering among African-American children in the 1950s could take on a kind of a broader significance for social reconciliation and racial reconciliation. And so I became interested, really, through those early conversations with Dr. Diggs, interested in the ways in which the story of the diseases rise from obscurity, its significance in the local context, and then its subsequent national politicization with made-for-TV movies and Hollywood motion pictures that were really focused on the experience of people with sickle cell disease, and then its subsequent history into the era of managed care was really a story that I think is a kind of an interesting microcosm of race and health in American society. So that's how it was a very haphazard, you might say, choice to go to Memphis. Mm-hmm. There's an academic reason why I chose Memphis, which is that often we focus on the history of disease by focusing on the researchers themselves, and we often focus on them by looking at kind of northern urban centers. So one finds a lot of history of health and medicine written about Chicago, let's say, or New York or Boston or Philadelphia, and relatively less written on the American South. And so it was my goal to try to address some of those issues as well.
Mm. Well, and certainly this disease was very important to the city of Memphis because as more and more attention was paid to it, that the result was that Memphis became an important, healthcare became an important part of the economy of Memphis, and this disease played a very important role in that.
That's quite right. In fact, as I dug deeper into this story and began to learn more about Memphis, what emerges is a kind of a portrait, really, of a society, of a city, and how it's changing. And one of the important backdrops to this changing significance of sickle cell disease, as you're suggesting, is unquestionably that in the early 20th century, most people in Memphis, even the public health establishment, even the physicians, despite Dr. Diggs's work trying to make this disease more visible, saw any health problems like infant mortality as a burden on the city. And they often sought to distance it, to not claim it as their own. And a lot of it has to do with the particularities of where Memphis is. It's right across the Mississippi River from Arkansas and immediately north of Mississippi. And often the public health attitude in Memphis, when anyone brought to their attention new diseases or high levels of disease, of health problems, was to say, those aren't our problems. Those are problems from Mississippi and problems from Arkansas that just end up on our doorstep because we have a healthcare system. And so, for instance, when in 1934 it was reported that Memphis had the highest infant mortality rate of any city its size in the country, the tendency among most practitioners was to say, well, this is just not our problem. This is a problem from these poor rural southern states that just happens to end up on our doorstep. So what was really necessary for the city to embrace research on a new disease like sickle cell was to have a broader change of mindset. And that only really happened after World War II, in a time in which you have an explosion of federally funded research that suddenly and new monies for hospital constructions in cities like Memphis, which suddenly makes the notion of being an academic center in the midst of rural poverty no longer a blemish and a particular burden, but a sort of an advantage for bringing in research funding or for bringing in hospital construction dollars. And so what you end up seeing is that the way in which the city chooses to embrace new health problems children's cancer, leukemia, in the 1950s with the construction of St. Jude's Hospital, or new children's hospitals, or sickle cell disease clinic, really is a reflection of the altered mindset of the city and how that is shaped by the availability of resources in the 1950s and the post-World War II era.
We are coming close to our midpoint here. Perhaps I should again introduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're speaking with Keith Wailu. He is professor of social medicine and history at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And we're talking about a book that he's written that looks at the history of sickle cell anemia. It's titled Dying in the City of the Blues, and it is focused on the city of Memphis. That's the city that the title refers to. Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina Press at Chapel Hill is the publisher of the book. Should be available if you would like to look at it. It should be available in bookstores, or they could get it for you, I imagine. And questions also welcome. 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-WILL. Maybe we've talked a little bit more about how it is the understanding of this disease developed over time. We talked about the fact that it was in 1910 when this physician in Chicago took a blood sample from this young student and looked at it and saw these sickle-shaped cells, and that's where the name came from. But it was several decades, I think, before scientists, physicians actually began to understand what caused this, what really this was about.
That's right, and that understanding also emerged in the 1950s with the work of Linus Pauling, who was the physician or the researcher who discovered what you might say is the molecular basis, the origins of the sickling process in the hemoglobin within the red blood cells. And this too, this discovery also sort of enhanced the scientific significance of the disease. No longer was it simply an obscure pathology that could be attributed to a number of different infectious diseases. It took on a scientific novelty, and because it became associated with the agenda of molecular biology as it was rising as a scientific discipline in the 1950s and into the 1960s. So part of the story of this disease is how a particular disorder or a particular experience of patients can take on renewed or enhanced significance when it becomes important to a particular research agenda within a particular discipline, in this case, molecular biology. The other thing that I wanted to say was that in subsequent years after Pauling's discovery, as the disease took on greater social significance for African Americans as an index of their experience, pain and suffering that had long gone ignored, at that point, in society, many would look back and say, well, isn't it ironic that the names that we have created for this disease, sickle cell anemia, alluding to the phenomenon that one sees when you look through the microscope, or hemoglobinopathy, alluding to what a molecular biologist would understand, really stand in somewhat stark contrast to the names that were created, let's say, in African cultures to describe not what you see through a microscope or what you understand using tools like electrophoresis, but the pain of the disease. Mm. So in the 1970s and 80s, you would find people referring to the names of this disorder that are given in African cultures, the Ga Chwe 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 or the Fante Nwiwiwi, which in the very nature of the disorders in the what's called onomatopoeia, they reflect the kind of the repetitive gnawing pain that the patient experiences. So in this book, I also try to both look at what we might say is the crucial benefits and the insight from biomedical perspectives, but also put them into a sort of a cultural context so we understand how they are intended to capture one aspect of the disorder while not really paying as much attention to those other aspects, mm-hmm. which might be more important in other cultural contexts.
I think one of the things that you also talk about that seems to cut several ways and can be problematic for a variety of reasons has to do with the understanding that scientists came to that this was an inherited disease.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, that one might, I suppose, draw some sort of odd comfort from it to say, as a way of saying, well, if someone has this condition, it's not their fault. They didn't do anything wrong. It's not because they're a bad person. It's simply because they inherited this genetic tendency to have it. On the other hand, that does indeed cut the other way because it raises all sorts of questions about, are you going to do screening? Are you going to do genetic counseling of people? Are you going to tell people that, well, we think it would be a good idea that you and the partner that you've chosen for yourself don't have any children because it's likely that they're going to have this disease? And it gets into all sorts of problematic areas where you look at traits being transmitted genetically and you get people into the idea that you start thinking that, though, on some sort of fundamental level, that means there's something wrong with these people.
That's right. And unquestionably, this is a good example of how advances in the scientific understanding of the hereditary nature of this disease could have obviously direct benefits for people understanding where this disease comes from, but also could be put to all sorts of problematic social uses. And that really was characteristic of the late 60s, early 70s, because as increasing attention was paid to this disorder and as the hereditary component became more central in those discussions, what emerged was genetic screening programs, which themselves became highly controversial because some of them revolved around things that we would think of as unproblematic, like simply informing two parents who have sickle cell trait of the chances of them having a child with sickle cell disease and letting them go forth in having children with that knowledge, which we regard as a beneficial development. But some of it also involved things that you might call more coercive practices, like what's called coercive or directive counseling, really trying to get people not to have more children. And it became a sort of a disease because of the genetic or the hereditary component in the 1970s, there was this kind of overtone of inferiority that became associated with this. And this was not helped at all by some of the biochemists and the scientists. For instance, Linus Pauling, the person who had made this important discovery of the underlying molecular basis of sickling, also wrote a UCLA Law Review article in the late 60s in which he suggested that perhaps we should put some kind of mark on the forehead of the people who have sickle cell trait so that they could learn to distinguish each other at an early age, and in a sort of a naive, I mean, a abhorrent idea, but also he took it to a naive extreme by suggesting that maybe they would recognize each other early in life and realize that it wasn't a good idea to fall in love. This is a kind of, this is the atmosphere in which, that surrounded the increasing knowledge of the hereditary nature of the disease, and it's not surprising, therefore, that genetic counseling took on a kind of a real questionable character, both in general society, but in many African American communities. Because on the one hand, as you said, as I said, you know, this is useful information to have. But if it's suggested that somehow people should be coerced into not having children, you can see how it became quickly associated with the issue, broader issues of reproductive control, genocide, etc.
Hmm. Well, there are other diseases where the tendency is transmitted genetically. There are even some, like Tay-Sachs, for example, that are identified with people of a particular ethnic background, in this case, Ashkenazi Jews.
That's right.
And then there are other sorts of genetic conditions that anybody could have. And we are now coming more and more to understand that it is possible to do, I think in some ways it's still fairly limited, but it is possible to do genetic sort of profiling, screening, and counseling. Having said all that, when you look at the ways in which African Americans were counseled and the way that sickle cell was approached with them, if you make comparisons between that and the way that other people with other genetically inheritable diseases were counseled, was there a big difference between the way that African Americans were treated and other Americans were treated?
Well, I think the political atmosphere was very different, and I would say, yes, there were differences. In fact, this question comes up frequently, that if one looks at let's say, Tay-Sachs counseling and screening, that it was relatively uncontroversial, and they were actually controversies, but it was far less controversial than sickle cell screening, and certainly for diseases like cystic fibrosis, which have a very similar kind of hereditary feature. I mean, it's identical in terms of heredity. There's very little in the way of concern. One needs to take into account a couple of things. First of all, Tay-Sachs is a fatal disease that's almost always fatal within the first few years of life. And so, whereas by the 1970s, kids with sickle cell disease, because of the developments that I've described in medical science, particularly the advent of penicillin and the ability to treat their infections, and the development of this kind of ability to understand the nature of the disease using the tools of molecular biology, it was possible to start to live into your adolescence and into your 20s, so that this is a very different kind of disorder than, let's say, Tay-Sachs. So the issue of choosing to have a child with sickle cell as opposed to choosing to have a child with Tay-Sachs was a very, very different issue in both in these two different communities. But I think, as I mentioned, you have to understand the broader context of the controversy in the early 70s when these issues first arose. Just before, you'd had Jensen and Shockley, two kind of notorious figures in the history of IQ testing, who argued and sort of got a lot of national attention that the fact that African Americans performed lower on IQ tests than majority groups and whites in particular was seen as an index for them of some kind of hereditary inferiority. You also had the fact that the 1972 was also the year in which the Tuskegee syphilis study was the scandal first emerged into public light. And so the idea of, in that context, of mandatory testing for children with sickle cell trait seemed to kind of, it was treated with a certain level of suspicion, right? Here you have one story of people saying that, well, African Americans are hereditarily inferior on the one hand, and you have a history of researchers who kind of see African American research subjects as tools, right, and withhold treatment for syphilis for decades. So the atmosphere is very different, and I think that as much as the actual practices being different was a significant feature of the controversy in the 1970s. In many ways, I would say that the genetic screening story for sickle cell disease was sort of a test case. Today, among many genetic counselors, they look back on the 1970s and they see these controversies as the point at which they learned that one needed to be very careful how one discussed these issues with particular groups. And in many ways, you might say that genetic counseling in Tay-Sachs or CF has really benefited and profited from those controversies with sickle cell disease, which were the first to happen on a national level.
In the early 1970s, sickle cell came to the attention of the nation in a way that it had not before. As you've mentioned, it was something that was dealt with in the media, certainly even within popular media. Mm-hmm. And also it was something that the federal government decided to address. This was during the Nixon administration. There was a passage of legislation that provided federal money for sickle cell research, for community-based clinics, for counseling. So it was at this time that the government decided this was a serious issue and wanted to put some serious money behind. Why is it that at that point that this became a national issue and something that the government decided that it needed to address on a national level?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it's complex. But I do think that it goes back to the ways in which, through the 1960s, the era of civil rights, of racial tensions, of protests, of enormous controversy around race relations, it's also in this time period that sickle cell disease became sort of widely known in the African American community and among various kinds of researchers and scientists, not just physicians, but also anthropologists and sociologists. And the primary feature of the disease that seemed most important in that time period was this issue of recurrent pain. Pain and suffering that had a long history of invisibility and neglect. And that's one of the motifs in the political discussion, which is the idea that this is a neglected disease. And if you remember some of the politics of race relations in the late 60s, early 70s, this question of, neglect, racial neglect, and creating various kinds of remedies to address this historical neglect was very much a kind of part of the political culture of the time. And so what I want to suggest is that sickle cell fit very neatly into this, certainly for liberals and certainly for the Democratic Party and for politicians on that side of the aisle. One of the challenges for me was to understand why it was that also people like Richard Nixon and Republican supporters, Congressman from Memphis, Dan Kuykendall, who was a staunch Nixon supporter and a Republican, also embraced sickle cell disease. And from that perspective, I learned something really new in doing this study, and that was that for them, Nixon made drug abuse a really significant issue, but part of his political campaign was also that we need to have sympathy for the people who seek out drugs. And for people like Kuykendall, the sickle cell story could become a story of that pointed to the fact that we needed to alleviate people's pain with this disorder before they turned to illegal means of alleviating their pain. So for individuals like, even on that side of the aisle or that side of the political fence, you might say, that this could be a story not just about sort of, knee-jerk liberalism or sympathy and compassion for African Americans. It could also be a story about taking appropriate measures to prevent things like drug abuse. And the other reason that Nixon embraced it on a kind of a larger level is that he was very much a fiscal conservative in the sense that he wanted to overall scale back National Institutes for Health funding by also focusing on a specific group of diseases that had some kind of political benefit for him. And that's why he waged the war on cancer, which we know very well in the early 70s. And for him, as he said in a speech in the early 70s, sickle cell disease is another disease that we ought to focus on. But this was all done in the context of reducing overall NIH research funding. So what I try to suggest in this book is that its rise to popular significance and its rise to political significance cannot be disentangled from the agendas one might say, of all of these different players, patients, clinicians, scientists, local politicians, and in fact, national politicians like Richard Nixon himself. So it's a complicated answer to your question.
Yeah. And is it not also the case, too, that then if you follow out this idea of we identify pain as an important symptom, we want to provide relief and comfort to people who have that symptom, we don't want them to turn to illegal drugs for that relief, so we should in an institutional sort of way address that. Was it, though, there not also some way in which you follow that out, and in fact that people started arguing, well, maybe providing aggressive pain relief is actually not such a good thing for the opposite reason, because somehow then it will lead people to become drug dependent.
And that is, in many ways, it leads us into the sort of controversies surrounding sickle cell disease in the era in which it becomes widely known. In many ways, over the last 30 years, these have been the sorts of debates that have revolved around the disorder. And the reason that I chose to focus on places like Memphis in particular is to show how, you know, local culture, local cultural values, attitudes towards addiction really shape the character of these discussions. In Memphis, which is a very conservative community with a long history of kind of concern about addiction and the use of drugs. As one researcher said, which I quote in the book, he says that, you know, we're afraid to engage in what one call liberal or, you know, expansive pain management. And he would say that similar researchers in Chicago or Oakland really disagree violently with us. They think that we undertreat. And part of my challenge was to not so much resolve this issue, which I think is not easily resolved, but to highlight the ways in which even the treatment for patients in particular clinical situations is really a reflection of changing attitudes towards the authenticity of their experience, and the thinking about the perhaps unintended consequences of compassion and what's called, you know, what you might call liberalism in pain therapy. On the other end of the spectrum, you have fairly good evidence to suggest that the instances in which regular pain management for sickle cell crises, as they're called frequently, lead to addiction are relatively low. But at the same time, you have lingering skepticism, particularly in emergency room settings, about whether the patients who come in are really in pain or whether they're simply seeking drugs. So that the part of the problem in the 80s and 90s is that sickle cell patients who are treated in inner city contexts, you know, where there's fear of drug addiction on the part of the community as well as in the clinic, are really dealt with differently. They're seen as perhaps an extension of the drug addiction problem rather than people with an authentic experience of pain that need to be treated. And part of what I try to do in this book is really not so much, it's the purpose for another project really to kind of look more closely at this and to weigh in on it. For the purposes of this book, I simply try to document this controversy and to explain why it has come about and various ways in which we might think about it.
We have just about 10 minutes left, actually a little bit less, and I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Keith Wailu. He's professor of social medicine and history at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The book that we've mentioned, if you'd like to look at it, is titled Dying in the City of the Blues, Sickle Cell Anemia and the Politics of Race and Health, and it's published by University of North Carolina Press. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Way back at the beginning of the program, I just mentioned the fact that you can trace the history of the way that we have thought about this disease as a kind of an arc, beginning from the point early in the 1900s when it was actually recognized. Then we got a better and better understanding about what it was about. Then we come perhaps to the period we've just touched on, that is in the 70s, when it was getting a great deal of attention in popular media, when the federal government was putting resources into doing research and providing services, dealing with the disease. Then if you come to the point where we are now, it seems to be something that nobody's even talking about anymore. There's been a great now falling off of emphasis placed on this over about the last 20, 30 years. How does one account for that?
Well, I think I would say less that it's been kind of falling off. It certainly isn't anywhere near the kind of obscurity that the disease had in the early 20th century. I would say that it and the new developments in sickle cell treatment are constantly kind of being the subject of news stories. So, for instance, the advent of hydroxyurea in a couple of years ago, which is a useful treatment for both the pain and also something called acute sick chest syndrome, which is characteristic of the disorder. The advent of these sorts of interventions have been or bone marrow transplantation in some instances, which can be a cure for the disease, but also comes with an enormous burden if it doesn't work. These sort of pop up in the news from one time to the next, and part of, I think, the concern is that these are not really treated. The pros and cons of these developments aren't looked at very, very closely, and so if one looks at the news, one senses that it shows up in the news from time to time. But at the same time, one has another trend going on, which is that the very academic healthcare centers that have been part of the growing awareness of this disease into the 1960s and 70s are themselves under a lot of pressure. We're in an era of managed care where a lot of these patients are being kind of pulled out of academic comprehensive care settings, being told maybe by the HMOs or by insurance companies or by other sorts of managed care forces that there's better care or more efficient care being provided elsewhere. And as a result, one of the things that some of the physicians in the book argue, that I quote in the book, argue is that the focus on sickle cell disease is by definition becoming less and less in this time period. So one of the things I argue is that it's not so much that it's becoming invisible again, but it's kind of the disease and the experience of the people is hovering between what I call sort of celebrity status, that's you hear about it every once in a while, and there's a gee whiz phenomenon, and the invisibility, which is that increasingly many of their experiences are being blurred against the backdrop of things like drug addiction, that their experience is not being treated as an authentic, you know, illness, but it's being seen as the extension of some broader social problem. So in a way, as you say, there is an arc to the book in the sense that the disease began the early 20th century in the invisibility and the obscurity of the broader context of childhood infectious disease, and we come to the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, and there's similar threats, one might say, to the way in which sickle cell is perceived and the experience of patients is actually administered to. And to me, as I say frequently, to me this is not so much a story about a disease per se or a particular patient's experience, but it's really a microcosm of broader issues surrounding race and health in America and also in Memphis.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I have two callers, and I want to try to at least get one, if not both. So let's go to Rantoul, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I was just wondering if you'd done it. I think I heard someplace that sickle cell anemia was the single allele was immunity for some kind of mosquito-borne illness. Is that...
That's a new understanding that emerges in the 1950s, which is done on the basis of I would say relatively just one study in northern Africa, which suggests that people with sickle cell trait have increasing resistance to a particular kind of malaria called falciparum malaria. And very quickly, this was taken on as a kind of dogma within environmental biology, evolutionary biology and molecular biology. And there's still, I think, some controversy, even though it's widely accepted within evolutionary biology, I think there's still some controversy because the reports from the field in areas of Africa where there's falciparum malaria is that people with sickle cell trait do, in fact, have falciparum malaria and often die from it. So the status of this argument is not, I think, as clinically sound as it is maybe appealing from the standpoint of sort of thinking about evolutionary biology. But what's interesting to me is how this argument has been put to use. And that is, you know, in the context of thinking about sickle cell trait and the inferiority debates of the 1970s, Memphis Congressman Dan Kuykendall actually tried to kind of turn the image of the disease around and say, well, instead of thinking about this as an inferiority disease, maybe we should think about people with sickle cell trait as being especially strong in areas where there's malaria. And maybe they should think about being missionaries. And to me, you know, it's as interesting the uses that those things are put to, whether or not they're true, as are the stories itself. But it's malaria that you're referring to. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sorry we have another caller we can't take, but we're simply at the end of the time. We want to say, Professor Wailu, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
Our guest, Keith Wailu, he is a professor of social medicine and history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And if you would like to read his book, the title is Dying in the City of the Blues, Sickle Cell Anemia and the Politics of Race and Health.